Hello, welcome to Home Baking. This is the podcast about home adventures in home baking through ingredients, history, and culture. Today, we're going to be talking about some homemade confections. We're going to be talking about fudge and honeycomb, as well as a little bit about the history of fudge and the word fudge, where that comes from, as well as I want to just point you in the direction of the newsletter, where I'm going to be doing a little tidbit on tempering chocolate, but I'm not going to talk about that in the episode. So if you want to find that, you have to go and look it up. It's homebaking.substack.com. So yeah, today we've got a salted vanilla fudge. We have got, which is a classic one. We've got a very, very, very easy two ingredient milk chocolate fudge, and we've also got honeycomb. So I'm very excited to get started today. I periodically do look at the reviews for this podcast and things, but one of them somehow escaped me. And so this is a review from the username that this person uses is Sri 4860, and it's on Apple Podcasts. And I just wanted to say a massive thank you because it is such a beautiful review. They said, "Interesting, inspiring, and even soothing. I'm so glad to have discovered this podcast. I've been listening since January 2022, and this was like about 6 months later, several mornings a week, either before work or while doing chores, and happily still haven't worked my way through even half the episodes. Instead, I find myself re-listening to so many. They're that enjoyable. Kate's delivery is so warm and spot on for home bakers, as her content is rich and inspiring. She gives so much wonderful detail in relation to techniques, tips, recipes, and variations, as well as having such generosity of spirit in publishing the efforts of numerous fantastic bakers. I've already bought several books thanks to this and loved every single one so far. So props for the discernment. I hope this podcast keep doing what it's doing. The vibe is perfect and every episode's a treat." That is so lovely. Thank you so much. It honestly means the world to me. And yeah, if you want to leave a review, please do, because it really helps people find the podcast. I'm just so touched, and I hope that the vibe is still the same, even though I've kind of taken a slightly different approach in the last couple of episodes. But I still hope you're still really enjoying it. So let's talk about fudge. So I had no idea about this. I found it so interesting that the word, the noun fudge, like the actual food product, has the same kind of origin as the verb to fudge something, which means like to put something together in a clumsy manner, or to kind of make it up, I guess, as well. I think it depends on where in the world you're speaking English, but here it actually means more so to make something up, like to fudge some figures or to fudge a report. You're kind of, you know, it's not entirely made up, but it's kind of like it's hastily put together, and potentially like some things are more of a guesstimate, if we can say it like that. So apparently sailors also used to use it as a retort, implying disbelief, like, "Oh, blah, 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 fudge, like, no way." So I didn't know that either. And fudge actually has its origin in the USA. I've always thought of it as being like a traditional British thing, but it's 100% not at all. It's just that I think we have adopted the tradition that you also have in America, that people also have in America, of like having fudge in holiday destinations. Like, that's, you know, you go on holiday and you buy some fudge and you bring it back to share with people. And we've kind of adapted to that to an extent. Like in Scotland, I don't know how old tablet is compared to fudge. It might be an older recipe, but you might bring back some tablet from Scotland, which is kind of like a grainier, more buttery type of situation, but very similar to fudge. Or if you go to Cornwall or Devon, somewhere in the southwest where they have a lot of clotted cream, you might bring back clotted cream fudge. Rum and raisin fudge is also really popular over here. What I found really interesting is that the original fudge contains chocolate. And a lot of, I'd say the most popular types of fudge here do not contain chocolate. If most, like, fudge is fudge. And then if you want to add chocolate, then it's chocolate fudge, it's not fudge. I might be wrong, but speaking as a British person, that's how I've always perceived it. So that really intrigued me, that it's, you know, the original recipes contain chocolate. So the idea is that this was something that you could put together, you could throw it together at home. And also somebody might have made a mistake. So they might have kind of fudged it up, if you like. So people started making fudge in earnest in, how do I say this? I think I've written this wrong. Mackinac Island? I'm really sorry if I'm saying that incorrectly, which is like the fudge capital of America in Michigan. And it was possible that somebody messed up a recipe for chocolate caramels. It's not 100% clear, but it might have been somebody in Baltimore rather than this island. And after that, it kind of traveled to various women's colleges around and about. So Vassar in Baltimore, Wellesley and Smith College, which are both in Massachusetts. And it was a way of kind of rebelling against the rules in those colleges by cooking in your dorm at night, which was against the rules, but you're still doing something that is pleasant and ladylike. So that's a little bit about the origins of the word fudge and the origins of the actual foodstuff itself. And let's get into talking about our recipes. But just before we do, I just want to say that I looked back at my notes and I apologise for not being able to read my own handwriting. It's Mackinac Island. I think that's how you say it. It looks incredibly beautiful, by the way. So, wow, it looks really, really gorgeous. And I can see why you would go on holiday there and take back fudge. It makes complete sense. Yeah, this is what happens when you can't read your own handwriting. So... all right, so let's get into talking about our recipes now, shall we? So the first one that we are going to be talking about today is our honeycomb. And it's a really quite a simple recipe. Now, for 2 out of 3 of these recipes, it's very helpful if you have a thermometer. So a sugar thermometer, or it could be a probe thermometer, which is what I have. Or if you've got one, an instant read thermometer is the best. And this is a recipe that I've adapted very slightly from one on the BBC Food website, which, by the way, is a really reliable source for lots of recipes, especially if you're interested in British baking. And so in the recipe, you need 200 grams of sugar. So I used caster sugar, but you can definitely use granulated. I don't think it matters that much. Just you might take like an extra 30 seconds to melt it, but other than that, it's the same. And that's about 1 US cup. You also need 110 grams, which is about five tablespoons of golden syrup. Or if you can't get hold of it, you can use corn syrup as well, or instead rather. You also need 2 teaspoons of baking soda or bicarbonate of soda, 2 gnomes, same ingredient. And finally, you need something to grease your tin, and you need some baking paper for your tin. So you want to grease and line your tin with baking paper. So Sarah Cook calls for an 8x8 or 20 centimetre square tin, but I prefer to use a baking tray because I quite like it a bit thinner and crunchier. So I will leave that up to you. And then you put your sugar and syrup into a pan over a low heat. You melt them together without boiling until the sugar has definitely dissolved. And then you turn the heat up, simmer it until it's a couple of shades darker and until it reaches 149 degrees C or 300 degrees Fahrenheit. If you, so I've made this 3 times. The first time I burnt it, so don't take it too dark. The second time I didn't take it up to that temperature and it went sticky. And then third time was the charm. So try to learn from my mistakes. Don't take your caramel too dark, but do heat it up enough so that it will eventually become crunchy rather than just sticky and chewy, which is kind of what happened to me. Don't get me wrong, it was still nice. But it was kind of hard to break up and a bit hard on your teeth. A bit more like toffee, really. So, yeah. And then once you've got it up to that temperature, you can take it off the heat and tip in the bicarbonate of soda or a baking soda all at once and then mix it in very quickly and thoroughly. Now, the reason why you want to do this super quickly is... So you want the chemical reaction to happen really, really quickly, but you don't want to have like lumps of baking soda in your honeycomb. And you kind of want it to carry on reacting as well when you've stopped stirring, because that'll make it even more crunchy. So ideally, yeah, tip it all in at once and then stir for your life, getting every last corner. But you don't want to kind of beat it so much that you're taking the air bubbles out, because then it's going to be flat. Do you see what I mean? So you want to kind of let it do its thing, but you want to make it as consistent a reaction as possible. Hope that helps. And then you scrape that into your tin, leave it to set for at least an hour, and then you can break it up. That's honeycomb. It's actually really simple. But the key here, well, there's a few keys actually. The keys here are, don't burn your caramel. Don't take it too dark. I think a couple of shades darker is enough. She says like a dark amber, which for me was too much. Definitely bring it up to the correct temperature, which isn't actually even mentioned in the recipe. In the original recipe, because otherwise it won't set correctly, and beat that in really well. Those are the 3 keys to honeycomb. And personally, I don't really like it on its own, but I love it in like crumbled over things in ice cream. It makes a great gift, especially for people who have got a very sweet tooth. And it's just delicious, isn't it? So that is honeycomb. I urge you to make it. It is actually very easy, as long as you got those few basic elements right. Yeah. So the temperature thing, I suppose if you know that it's very, very hot, you might not need to measure it, but you might know what you're looking for. If you know what you're looking for, if you made it over and over again, you'd be okay. But I feel like for a first time or a second time, I think it's a much safer option is to use the thermometer. All right. So we've got 2 more recipes to talk about. I want to just talk a little bit about the milk chocolate fudge, first of all. So this is kind of like a cheetah's fudge. It's not what I would consider a real fudge. It doesn't have the characteristic texture that I like, that I look for. But it is quite similar. It's quite close. It's kind of soft and yielding, but still a solid. And it's really sweet, but it's not like horrendously sweet. So in the recipe that I based this on, took as my lead, it says to use dark chocolate, but then it says you can use milk chocolate or white chocolate, and it's just a bit softer. I tried it with all three. Dark chocolate was too rich for me. If you are a dark chocolate person and you cut it into really, really small pieces, you might really like that. I did try it with white chocolate, and that was disgustingly cloying, so I wouldn't recommend it. And then I tried it with a high quality, high cocoa solid milk chocolate, and that was really nice. And it's so easy that I made it with a massive group of young people, and all they were doing was just melting it in the microwave, just checking it every 30 seconds or so, carrying on melting it. And we made three times the quantity as well, which was mad. We had like over a kilogram of chocolate. So that was incredible. Must have been like a kilo. Yeah, like a kilo and a half of chocolate nearly. So yeah, that was something. And three tins of condensed milk. But in order to make a more rational quantity for a family, rather than a massive youth group, what you want is 450 grams or 16 ounces of high quality milk chocolate. Mine was 35% cocoa solids. Something between 35, 38 is good here, I reckon. And then you want your 14 ounce or 397 gram tin of condensed milk, which in some countries is called sweetened condensed milk, but it is the same product. And all you need to do is chop your chocolate or break it into small chunks, melt that with the condensed milk. You can do that in a pan on a very low heat, because the sort of condensed milk will help stop the chocolate from burning, which is more likely to happen if you just put chocolate on a heat. Or you can do it in the microwave in short bursts. And you just melt it together, you give it a really good stir, and then you put it into your tins or your boxes, and that is literally it. And then leave it to set at room temperature or in the fridge. I prefer to leave it at room temperature. I found it gets a bit hard in the fridge. And then I'd say you have to eat this one within a few days. So it is less stable than a classic fudge. It goes hard over time. The moisture seems to leave it somehow. And yeah, it kind of is not as nice after a few days. So you have to kind of eat it up. So that is our milk chocolate fudge. And we are going to be talking also about a salted vanilla classic fudge, which is my favourite in this episode. Before we get into the salted vanilla fudge recipe, which, trust me, is well worth listening to, is absolutely fabulous, I also wanted to give a little life update, which is very exciting for me. I talked about a couple of episodes ago, we talked about Bulgarian kozanak, and I was making this kozanak for my neighbour's approval, and her grandmother made the best kozanak, and she was really looking for this like stringy texture and soft moist bread. Guess what, she told me that this kozanak was the best she'd ever eaten other than her grandmother's. I'm so proud. I'm like made up. It was is honestly like so heartwarming and nice to have my food enjoyed so much. And her mum like really enjoyed it as well. So I just thought, I've impressed a Bulgarian grandmother and I've impressed a Bulgarian mother whose grandmother made the best kozinak around. So I'm very, very happy about that. She said that you're meant to be able to eat kozinak without having to have a drink with it. It's meant to be sort of moist enough and soft enough that you don't have to kind of wash it down with a cup of tea or a glass of milk. And she said mine was perfect in that regard. And she said it's meant to have this made of strings texture that I talked about on the podcast, where if you pull it apart, it kind of comes through in little stringy parts. And the way that we achieved that was through shaping it very vigorously. We shaped it, we rolled it into like ropes, and then we twisted those ropes, and then we plaited those ropes. And that's how we achieved that texture. And so it's involved, but I'm just so glad that it actually worked and that she actually liked it. I'm just made up about it. So I wanted to talk to you about that. I mean, there are some bad things going on in my life as well at the moment, unfortunately, as well. I got up at 4 a.m. the other day and my bathroom was flooded, so that was fun. So we're trying to get that sorted, but we've got to go through the people that manage the building and the landlords upstairs and our landlord. So it's all a bit of a mare. But on the upside, I did make fantastic kozinak, so I'm very pleased and proud about that. All right, let's talk about salted vanilla classic fudge. Now, this is another recipe that I found on the BBC Food website. This one is from Katie Gilhooly. And a bit like the honeycomb, but these are even more important, these rules I'm going to talk about. This has got a few absolute golden rules. Okay, so before you start, as long as you follow these rules, you cannot go wrong, because baking is, I mean, it is an art, but it is also a science, right? So rule number one, the temperatures have to be right. If you don't get the temperatures right, it will be sticky and sort of, or liquid or like toffee-ish, it won't be fudge. You have to beat it. So when you're bringing it down from the high temperature to a lower temperature, you have to keep beating it for quite a long time, because it is crucial to the texture. Now, if you were to make this in the traditional way, you would work it instead on a big marble slab. But we here are just going to use a stand mixer. If you don't have a stand mixer, you can use a bowl and a very strong patient arm, or take it in turns with people to beat the fudge. But you have to kind of beat it for quite a long time. And then golden rule number three is that you need to let it set at room temperature. If you put it in the fridge, it is likely to go sticky and more toffee-like or more caramel rather than fudge-like. So as long as you follow those three golden rules, I would say that you basically can't go wrong. And it is incredibly delicious. So our ingredients are as follows. We want 397 grams, which is a tin of, or 14 ounce tin of condensed milk, which may be called sweetened condensed milk in your country. You want 460 grams, which is roughly 2 US cups and 4 tablespoons of light muscovado sugar. That gives it a lovely, lovely flavour. You want exactly 150 millilitres or grams, which is very, very just, like really just under 2/3 US of a US cup of whole milk. Or high fat milk, which is like, I think it's like 3 or 4%. Yeah. I think it's 3% fat. And then you want 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract. and you want 125 grams of salted butter. Or you can use unsalted butter and you can add a bit more salt. You want half a teaspoon of fine salt, and then I'd say use up to 3/4 teaspoon if your butter is unsalted. And then you also want some flaky salt, or even some vanilla salt if you've got any, to put on the top when you're finishing. So those are our ingredients, and our method is as follows. So you want to butter and line an 8x8 inch square tin, or 20 centimeter square tin. You want to heat the butter, condensed milk and sugar together until the sugar dissolves. Then you want to bring that to the boil and simmer it until it reaches 116 degrees C. Absolutely crucial. In some circumstances, apparently can go up to just 113, but it does depend on humidity. So I would say go on the safe side, go way all the way up to the top end of the measure, which is 116. It can go a little bit higher, by the way, but it needs to reach 116 C or 241 Fahrenheit. Absolutely essential. Then cool it down to just let it cool to about 110 C or 230 Fahrenheit. Then transfer that hot liquid to your stand mixer or to another bowl and just beat it really well until it cools to 60 C or 140 Fahrenheit. And once it's reached 60 C, you then spoon it into the tin, smooth over the surface with like the back of a spoon or a palette knife, and crumble over your flaky salt, and then leave it to set at room temperature. It sounds simple. It is simple. You know, it's not that many ingredients. I forgot to say about the milk, but you basically bung all of the ingredients in together. Then I would add your vanilla extract in at the end. I'm sorry, I forgot to say that. So you'll heat your butter, condensed milk and sugar. Okay. And then bring that to the boil and then beat really well. Bring that to the boil, cool it a bit, then add your vanilla extract, then beat it. I hope that's okay. I'm really sorry about that mistake. That's the only thing that I think I messed up on there, but yes, it sounds quite simple, and it is simple, but there's just a little bit of technical knowledge, you know, a bit of science here. So as long as you get that right, that's cool, and it's going to be fabulous. If you don't have a thermometer, there is another method called the soft ball stage method. So basically you get a little spoon of the mixture and to check it whether it's reached the right temperature, you put that spoon in a bowl of iced water, and then you're looking for it to become a soft squidgy ball as opposed to like a liquid caramel or like a sticky mess. Now to me, having that out and having a bowl of iced water ready to go and all of that, it's much more of a pain than just using a thermometer, but that method does exist if you don't have one and you don't want to buy one, which, you know, fair enough. That's up to you. And that's it. That is our salted vanilla fudge. So those are our recipes today. All that's really left for me to do is give you some information about where to find these things and talk about what's coming up next. Now, if you know me, you know that I always like to talk about variations and how you can make recipes your own. In terms of the salted vanilla fudge, there is not a single thing that I would change about it. It had the perfect consistency, for me, the perfect flavour. Now, you might want to try adding something instead of the vanilla. I think that bourbon, if you like bourbon, would work really well. I think that rum would work really well. But for me, it was perfect as it is and I wouldn't change anything. In terms of the milk chocolate fudge, I would add nuts next time. It's nice as it is, but it would be nicer with nuts. And then in terms of the honeycomb, it's just honeycomb. Just make it correctly. And then it's good in and on loads of things. It's sort of, you know, you're sort of actually making an ingredient, really, I would say. It's not really a full dish, is it? So, or a full treat, not to me anyway. So some people do like snacking on it on its own, but for me, I prefer to crumble it over things, on things, stir it into ice cream, etc., put it in a sundae, all of that good stuff. So those are my little notes on variations and things you might want to try at home. And we were going to talk about what is coming up next. And also to do a few quick plugs. So do please go to our new website. It is homebaking.substack.com and sign up to the newsletter. Please, it would mean the world to me. I would love to land in your inbox every time a new episode comes out with the written recipes and links. That would be really lovely. So go to homebaking.substack.com. If you don't want to sign up but you still want to access all of it, you still can, no problem. You just click like no thanks, whatever, I can't remember what it is, and then you can still see everything. It's all up there for free. Please go and look at it. There's lovely pictures as well. And in time I'm going to be just kind of making sure all the archive is in the same place and stuff like that. So that's quick little plug. And in terms of what is coming up next, good question. All right, so the next episode is going to be the first one in a little series that I'm calling Bake the World. Because I am English, not that I ever mention it, but because I'm English, I think we kind of have to start with England. Which I was sounding like I'm dreading that, but I'm not at all. I'm actually really excited about it because I've chosen like my favorite recipes. So I'm really excited. We're going to be making, and I want to just chat a little bit about British baking and what you are looking for in British baking, because I feel like there's a lot of misconceptions about it, or I should say English, I guess, because we're just doing England. But it's, you know, it's actually meant to be simple, rustic, homely. That's kind of the key with English baking. So the favourite recipes that I'm going to be talking about are Victoria sandwich, or sometimes called Victoria sponge cake. We're going to be which is obviously a classic, a tea room, cream tea time, old fashioned, classic. Any more adjectives? I don't know. And then we're also going to be talking about one of my favourites that I feel is like very under-celebrated, even in this country, which is Eccles cakes. You like you don't actually find them that often outside of like Derbyshire. But they are wonderful. They're so good. They truly are delicious. We're going to be talking about another one of my all-time favourites, which is also from Derbyshire, which is a Bakewell tart. I've talked a little bit about Bakewell pudding before, but this time it'll be Bakewell tart. And also, as if that wasn't enough, we're going to be talking about two savoury pies. Now, I know how much people from outside Britain are like interested in our history of, well, some people are anyway, maybe a lot aren't, but you know how some people are interested in our history of savoury pies, and it's kind of very quintessentially English and British. And they're going to both be meat-based, actually. Now, when I started this podcast, I was vegetarian, and I'm not any longer. I've gone back to eating meat again. I don't eat it that often, but a lot of our very traditional pies are meat-based. it wasn't necessarily always the highest quality. Sometimes it was often very padded out with potatoes. Often you would have loads of offal in there as well as the nicer cuts. You tend to have cheaper cuts of meat like flank. You know, you wouldn't go for a fillet steak or something. But I think there's no escaping the fact that a lot of our traditional savoury pies are meat-based. So, I'm going to be talking about those. But they're both going to have a spicy twist. And even though you might think that's not very traditional, well, it is for two reasons. The first reason is that in the past, not so much anymore, but in the past, we did have spiced beef pies. And like minced pies originally contained meat, which I've talked about before. So we definitely, it definitely was a thing. And the second reason is that we have a significant history of immigration. We always have. Even Anglo-Saxons were migrants because they are of German origin. And it's part of our national identity that we love curry. Like it's one of our favourite things. And there are curries that were born here. Like tikka masala is not a traditional Indian dish. Balti is not a traditional Indian dish. I don't think vindaloo is either. Like there's numerous curries that were invented here by primarily actually Bangladeshi and Pakistani people running curry houses, and partly to meet demand of British people or English people. And their tastes, and partly as the result of trying to cook in a high-paced kitchen environment. So it is actually very English to talk about curry, even though that might seem a bit strange. And I currently work in a predominantly South Asian Bangladeshi area. So it's a really important part of our national culture is that a lot of us go back far enough and we are immigrants. So, or even if you don't go back far enough, you know what I mean? So depending on the person. So that's what we're going to be talking about. Three sweet treats. I think it is three, isn't it? There's a lot. So the Victoria sponge, Eccles cakes, Bakewell tart. And then we're going to be talking about a tandoori chicken pasty. It's as good as it sounds, made with rough puff pastry. Even better, I know. And then we're going to be talking about a traditional beef suet pie, but we're going to make that spiced. We're going to use like warm spices in that to make it even more delicious. So, and try, you know, we don't want our kind of reputation as a country is that our food is bland. So I didn't want to just make like a beef pie with very little in it, which to be fair, most of us would quite happily smash that down as well. But let's try and make it a little bit more interesting. So those are what is coming up next time in 2 weeks. There's a lot for me to bake and review and talk about, so but I'll try and keep it quite tight. And then after that, I haven't 100% decided, if I'm honest. I think the next episode is going to be quite an intense period of researching and baking, so I might do something that's a little bit more low-key. I still really need to do this episode about donuts that I've had in the works for ages. There's an episode that there's sort of loads of things on my list that I want to talk about and have episodes around. So there's ube, there's Syrian baking. I'm really excited to talk about that. More Syrian sweet dishes as part of the Bake the World series. Oh, one of them, one that I am going to be doing soon is Portuguese baking. So I'm very excited about that. So I will keep you posted. But yes, in 2 weeks, we are going to be starting Bake the World and we'll be starting in my home, England. So I can't wait to see you then. And this is nearly the end of the episode. My PS for today is I was listening to Alison Robicelli on Food 52's Burnt Toast podcast, a slightly old episode, and there's a discussion on there about offal that I fully disagree with, and I am curious to know if any listeners what you might think about that. Now, there's loads of offal that I think is delicious. And things that I've always eaten. So for me, the cheeks of a fish and a pig are basically the best bit. The eyes off a fish, I always eat. If I'm eating a whole fish, I always eat the eyes. It sounds horrific, but they're crunchy and they're actually really nice and they're really good for you. Like, they're tiny, but you know, they're full of iodine and like they're just good for you and delicious. What else do I eat? I love chicken hearts. So in my area, because they're eaten, I think they're eaten sometimes in Turkish cuisine, you can buy these like big bags of them in the butchers. And what I tend to do is I marinate them in soy sauce and brown sugar and salt, maybe some chili flakes as well or something, and then I skewer them and I barbecue them, and they are really, really good, like genuinely really good. Chicken hearts are great, chicken liver is great, lamb's liver is great, just genuinely really delicious. There are some things that I am not keen on. Brains, not keen. What else am I not keen on? Kidneys, not keen. But they are really like popular. Kidneys are really popular type of offal in traditional British food. Not so much these days, but like steak and kidney pie is a huge deal, for example. Yeah, so there's loads of offal that I think is like legitimately delicious. Not just because I'm like trying to be cool and trendy, but like actually is nice. Some types of tongue are nice if they're treated in the correct way. I've had cured tongue that was really delicious. I think it was beef. So there's loads that is actually, I think, really nice. I've had sweetbreads. Some sweetbreads are really delicious, despite what they are. So I think that I like fish roe as well. There's two different types of roe, hard and soft. I like both. But soft roe, I used to have it when I was growing up on toast, and it is just with salt and pepper, it is so good. So yeah, I fully disagree. Like, there's loads of offal that I think is delicious, and I kind of think if we're going to kill animals for food, we should eat everything that is edible / not horrifically disgusting. So I'm kind of all for like a nose to tail approach if we are going to continue to eat meat, which I think personally, I think we should reduce our meat consumption as a global population. But in order to sort of curb climate change and stuff, But yeah, where we do continue to eat it, I think we should try and be resourceful about it. So that's my two cents on offal. And I think offal can be awfully good. What do you think about it? What do you think is nice? What do you think is gross? Where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line at tongue? or something at sweetbreads? Or like me, do you reject kidneys and brains? So yeah, that's it for today. I hope that hasn't put you off any meal that you're about to eat. I hope it hasn't turned you vegetarian if you didn't want to be already. And I will see you in 2 weeks when we're going to talk about curry chicken pie and spicy beef pie and Victoria sponge and Eccles cake and Bakewell tart. I'm so excited. Okay, bye.